with a revolutionary warship.
A Federation ship with a cloaking device?
Engage.
On a voyage to the farthest edge of the galaxy.
Our mission is to take the Defiant into the Gamma Quadrant and try to find the leaders of the Dominion.
The crew must stand united.
No one is expendable.
To battle the greatest threat to Federation peace.
Prepare to abandon ship!
On the next exciting episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, joining the Great Link once and for all.
And beaming in... Oh, hold on. Tyler, there's something wrong with the transporter.
Yeah, it looks like one Benjamin Yong turned into a Vulcan first officer on the USS Enterprise. Oops.
That horrible scream.
Yeah. For all of those who recall, we did promise that we'd have a special guest on the podcast this week. However, our former co-host, and I guess I want to say former friend, Benjamin Yong, he couldn't make it for some reason.
Yeah, it's snowing here in Vancouver as we record this. Well, actually, is it?
No, it's not.
But to Ben, it's snowing quite hard.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Cam, what is our conundrum this week?
So this week, we are going to talk about the DS9 two-parter, The Search. Now, we've talked about two other DS9 two-parters so far, with the Emissary and also the McKee. But this is the one that I feel like is maybe the most important. And I think it's really exciting, actually, for us to talk about Deep Space Nine at this point in time. Do you know why?
Tell me, Cam.
Because of the exciting new release, Tyler. I don't know if you've heard.
Yes.
But home video is about to get a lot more exciting.
Tell me, is it coming to Blu-ray finally, Deep Space Nine?
It's definitely going to be on a disc.
Well, a floppy disc?
Well, not that far off, really. Okay. DS9 is being re-released on a DVD box set.
It's being released for the first time ever on DVD?
No, not so much the first time. This is really the second time.
So you're trying to tell me this is just a double dip, Cam?
Well, there's no actually... It doesn't seem like there's any new features, so...
It's just different packaging, Cam? Is that all?
That might be all.
Oh, dear.
And it looks like the art is a lot worse. And vaguely erotic in some cases.
Yeah, I took a look at that art, Cam. It is quite titillating.
That's Sisko and Bashir Season 7 cover. Oh, my.
There's fan fiction all about it, so it's good that they were able to inspire something with that artwork there,
now,
too.
Tyler, you're someone who's many times on the show expressed your disappointment at the lack of Deep Space Nine on Blu-ray.
Oh, yes.
Did this news just feel like a knife twisted into your side, or was it just kind of like, yeah, I expected this?
I think when I saw the headline, all I read at first was, you know, Deep Space Nine to be released, it said re-released, but I just read it as released.
Right. And you ran screaming into the streets, yes.
Well, for that half second it took me to read that part of the headline, I was like, wow, this is finally happening. This is going to be my best Christmas ever.
So now it's your worst.
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, very lame news, I have to admit.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of underwhelming.
Wow.
But
you know what? We can talk about something that I don't think was so underwhelming. It's The Search Parts 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
I find this a very fascinating episode. There's a lot of firsts going on here. But, Cam, why don't we jump into it? Something we always do. We talk about our first experiences watching. What was your first reaction the first time you watched The Search Parts 1 and 2 just a few short years ago?
I remember getting a lot of sort of emotion out of Odo discovering the Founders. When my memories of this two-parter really all hinge around that. That's what I really remembered. It was Odo going back, you know, discovering the Great Link, meeting Salome Jens as the head Founder, and then, of course, discovering the Jem'Hadar down below and discovering that the Founders were behind the Dominion. That is what I recalled. What was really interesting revisiting it was how much I'd forgotten about key plot twists and so forth.
Okay. We can go into the plot twists a little later on. I want to say that when I watched this 20 years ago, it was a time where Star Trek The Next Generation was off-air. Voyager had yet to premiere. This was the only Star Trek on television. So this is very important to me. I was not a huge Deep Space Nine fan as a young child at that time, or I guess it would have been around 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. And so I was getting into it. I think this was like a very good season premiere. As a kid, there's other little things that I was noticing. Like, they had new comm badges in this premiere. We had a new hairstyle for one Jadzia Dax.
Does that last more than this two-parter?
Nope.
Yeah. I liked it, actually. I thought it was a good look. It had kind of like an alien look, which I always like when Star Trek does, because a lot of the hairstyles actually look dated.
Yeah.
Over time, but I thought this one actually worked.
Not to mention all the new sets, the Bridge of the Defiant, their really shabby crew quarters, as well as the new... briefing room that was here for the first time. A couple new characters made their appearance. One who lasted a little while longer. I'm looking at you, one Lieutenant Commander Eddington versus one Sub-Commander T'Rul. But
who was supposed to be an ongoing character originally.
Why don't we dive into her a little bit later on?
Yeah,
because,
I'd like to.
But honestly, I think this is an episode that was trying to kind of reset Deep Space Nine for a lot of new viewers. I think that they knew this would be their shot because there was no other Star Trek on TV at that particular moment. So they figured, did this not give you vibes of kind of a not necessarily a reset, but like almost a reinvigoration of what Deep Space Nine could be?
It feels like a real boost in confidence in the series. Mm-hmm. Like when you watch, and I've been working my way through season one and two of Deep Space Nine, this last little bit, rewatching them. And at that point in time, the show really does feel like they're kind of discovering what the show is, but they're not, it doesn't feel like they're putting a huge amount of effort into it. Whereas you compare that to sort of the latter seasons of TNG, it really feels like they're kind of putting all of their heart into trying to come up with at least new story ideas and new ways of kind of tackling that series, even if they aren't successful.
Yeah.
Whereas DS9, it feels like they play it safe a lot. Like, they're like, well, here's an episode where something similar to an episode of TNG, you know, happens. This does not feel like that. Like, I feel like when you get into this two-parter especially, it feels like what DS9 is. Now, I was curious, you mentioned before about how, you know, new comm badges, new sets. Was there because there was no other Star Trek series on the air, was there any sort of boost to the budget at this point?
I don't believe so.
No?
Yeah, keep in mind, Star Trek Voyager was being produced concurrently as this was. It just did not premiere until, I guess, 4 or 5 months later.
Right.
Because remember, they had all those extra episodes of Star Trek Voyager that did not, that were produced for season one, but they did not air until season two.
Right, yes. So we got to close off the season with Tuvok running laps.
Yeah, and Learning Curve. Learning Curve was not supposed to be the season finale of Star Trek Voyager season one. Shocking, I know, but I think it was actually supposed to be the 37s, which ended up being the season premiere of season two, which is a strong season premiere.
Yeah, I like that episode.
Yeah, but for this, I definitely think that if you look at the names attached to the writer credits here. You have Ron Moore writing his first episode of Deep Space Nine. You also have Ira Stephen Barrow writing part two. I think Michael Piller is pretty tied up with, you know, getting going on Star Trek Voyager. I really do think that he was handing the reins over to one Ira Stephen Barrow. And Ira Stephen Barrow, I don't think he's a guy who really played it safe when it came to Star Trek. And I think this premiere shows that.
Michael Piller is one of the great voices of TNG. Do you think he was just an ill fit for DS9 from the start?
Well, like an ill fit, yeah.
I mean, Iris Demon Bear is so much to me the heart and soul of what DS9 is.
Yes.
And it has this sort of unique sensibilities and outlook on the franchise. I just wonder if this for this show to succeed, and you know, and as we'll talk about in this two-parter, you need Iris Demon Bear's vision. Whereas Michael Piller, I mean, his vision was TNG, and, you know, he was fantastic at it. I just wonder if that vision belonged on TNG, because we would even see Voyager would be a little bit clunky.
I absolutely know what you're saying, and I think, you know, the writing, the writer's room that was assembled for Deep Space Nine, they seem like they're made for Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Piller, just a lot of the, if you look at where he had his strongest influence, is seasons 1 and 2 of Deep Space Nine. Voyager, TNG, Enterprise, what have you. Star Trek doesn't usually come out of the gates all that strong. It usually takes them a little while to get going.
Fingers crossed for Discovery.
Well, my expectations are being tempered quite a bit right now.
Yes.
So I think it's tough to say if what was going on during the Piller era of DS9 was because he was, you know, really in the driver's seat much more so than our Stephen Bear, who's there pretty much from day one.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it was just one of those natural things that Star Trek always has to go through, is hitting all those bumps in the road before you figure out how to get on that smooth pavement and just go flying right down the highway of the stars.
That was a very tortured analogy.
Thank you.
So let's talk about The Search, because this is... You know, I think when fans talk about DS9 to maybe people that aren't as big a fan of DS9 or people who are interested in watching the show, a lot of the times they'll tell non-fans to maybe skip most of season 1 and 2.
Sure.
So I think for many people, they would be recommended to start around this point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you think The Search does mark like a really strong relaunch of what DS9 is? Do you think it does require a lot of previous knowledge from the previous seasons?
You know what? Honestly, I think with just the previously on Deep Space Nine that preceded this episode, that explained a lot that happened in the Jem'Hadar.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of, like, I think Ron Moore is actually good at kind of combining exposition, like making exposition interesting.
Yeah.
So we have that going where, like I said, there's a lot of setup going on. They're explaining what the Dominion is, what the Defiant's doing here, why Starfleet has commissioned a warship, where it came from, it because of the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going through the wormhole. You have a very lost Odo trying to find himself. I think this is like a very fantastic way to really reset the series for a lot of people that would want to be interested in just watching Star Trek on television because they had no other channels for this at this point.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think, Cam?
I felt the same way. Like, when I was watching part one, I was actually getting a little frustrated almost. Not in a way where I was, like, not enjoying it, but just in the sense of, like, all I was thinking was, like, I do not remember part one of this two-parter being so heavy on table setting.
Okay.
Like, my memories of it were more that, you know, I kind of got swept up, and maybe I did the first time through because all this stuff was new to me. Whereas once you kind of know the series and go back, a lot of this explanation stuff, you're like, yeah, I know this.
See, you know, I was actually quite enamored with part one because I was just appreciating how early it was in the series run and the grasp of the characters that Ron Moore had. And I'm sure the episode is rewritten he had a lot of input from the other writers who had been there for the previous two seasons. But just the strong character moments. Like, these seem very fleshed out. It didn't seem awkward. I understood the motivations for all the characters throughout this episode. So to me, table setting, but I actually just found it very, very fascinating myself.
I mean, it's very consistent, this two-parter.
Yeah.
I think the two work together well, but it's kind of like the Inception problem. A lot of people walked out of Inception saying, you know, the first half of that movie explained things a lot.
Sure.
But you need that to get to the second half. But just in terms of revisiting, I didn't remember that being this much.
Tell me specifically what maybe you found distracting, or maybe what took you out of the episode. Because nothing jumps out to me. Like, I understand what you're saying, that there is that table setting, but I think it was done quite well, personally.
I think, I'm not arguing it's not done well. I'm just arguing there's a lot of it.
Okay.
The sense, like, explaining, you know, why they're going through the wormhole, what everything is, what the Defiant is. All of these details, which of course, as someone who's worked her way through the series, I now take for granted because I know all this stuff.
Sure, but as somebody who had never seen any of this before...
It works 100% well. Like, this did not faze me at all the first time I watched it. It was just in terms of revisiting it, I was kind of more surprised at how much exposition there actually was, because in my mind, it was much more of a just straight, sweeping story.
Well, let me ask you this, and There's so much more I want to unpack with this episode, but what do you think?
I think I'm about done. So on that note,
what do you think was a stronger part, part one or part two?
I would argue part two.
See, I would argue part one.
Interesting.
I'm not a fan. So Cam, I'm going through my season 5 Blu-rays of Next Generation, and I just watched A Matter of Time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's one featuring one Berlin Hoff Rasmussen.
Yeah.
And by the end of the episode, it seems as if the crew has figured out that this Berlin Hoff Rasmussen is a bit of a con man. But the crew does not let the audience in on that. So it comes as a bit of surprise when Rasmussen tries to use a phaser on Data and the phaser doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it when the storytellers are trying to pull a fast one on the audiences.
What if it works twice on the same idiot?
Well, okay. Oh, really? Okay, because Cam, like, as I was watching all of part two, the whole time I was thinking, like, oh yeah, they're just in, like, this kind of coma, this Inception world.
I had totally forgotten that.
Really?
And I was scratching my head. I'm like, man, I did not recall Necheyev ever being this unlikable on the show. I was like,
Garrick dies.
Well, I didn't think he died. I thought he got stunned. I was, genuinely confused a lot of times.
Really?
Yeah, it was bizarre. I don't know why I had no memory of that.
See, I thought that would have just been telegraphing to you that this is kind of a fake reality. Because for those who don't recall, the Dominion had put a number of the crew members into this sort of stasis and throughout created essentially a dream that they had to live through to test the Federation's response to a Dominion treaty.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like it when that happens to me, when I'm watching something. You know, spoiler alert for somebody who's never seen Breaking Bad, but do you remember that one finale in which Walt had that sort of poison that he used on that child?
Yeah.
But they never actually explained it to the audience until after it happened.
Right.
And I like being up to date with where the characters. I feel as if I know where the characters are going. Otherwise, it's hard for me to invest in what's going on. After, everything was revealed, Cam, did you not feel as if all of those scenes on Deep Space Nine, a lot of the great Garrick moments, it was all for naught because it didn't actually happen to Garrick?
Not at all. Like, I
really
love...
But it's not Garrick actually saying these great one-liners.
It doesn't matter to me. I love it when a great storyteller misleads me and kind of, flips the script on me. Like, I love, say, Brian De Palma's, Femme Fatale. You know, movies that genuinely will have you going down one road and then suddenly flip it on you completely. I just absolutely love that when it's done well. I think, when you see it done badly, those little times where people make fun of it and ridicule the movie or show or whatever. But to me, I love it when it's done well, and I think it's done really well in this episode.
Okay.
And I love how it's also contrasted with a story that isn't. A con, essentially, which is, everything going on with Odo and Kira, which to me has so much emotion to it, and I am so wrapped up in. So kind of the two working in tandem to me really just had me totally engrossed.
See, I think what you're really getting at, though, and this is what I think, is I think this story, the dream story, is actually a good story.
Mm-hmm.
If that stuff is actually taking place in reality, I would say, yeah, that's great stuff going on, but it's not. So I essentially, it means nothing to me. When I was watching it, knowing that it was all just a dream, it really meant nothing to
me. You needed my level of just obliviousness.
I think so. I don't know. So for those at home, who've been watching, say, HBO's Westworld, the season finale just aired, this past week. And that's a show I find incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot from people.
The characters are just very paper thin, and it's really all built around guessing the twist or figuring out the twists. Mm-hmm. And I don't like it when the storytellers are trying to pull a fast one on the audiences, especially nowadays. Like, everybody watching Westworld had already figured out these twists by episode 2.
Oh, really?
And when they were all revealed in episode 10... It was just like, it felt so flat to me.
Was there 10 episodes? Is it wrapped now?
Yeah.
And so, when Westworld was over, were you excited to see any more of it?
Yeah, because I think what happens is, they've actually really set up season... I really hope the head writers of Westworld, they've kind of learned from the criticisms, of season 1, because I think what they've set everything up for her season two, I think season one of Westworld is a perfect example of place setting done very poorly.
Okay, interesting.
But they've set up season two to be something very fascinating that I'm very excited to watch. But I think the problem is, despite some great performances, you didn't care about vast majority of the characters. There's really only one character, Tandy Newton's character, that I thought was actually interesting at all. And this is a series featuring, like, Jeffrey Wright and Anthony Hopkins. So.
Yeah.
Anyways, a bit of a tangent, but It's interesting that we're both on different sides, because the whole time I was watching this, I was just like, well, you know, like, these are two strong episodes, but I definitely prefer part one, because I'm invested in what's happening, because it's actually happening in reality.
Okay, well, let's talk about part one then.
Yeah, okay.
Now, what were some of the things that really jumped out to you that you really fell in love with?
You know, just Odo not really knowing what his place is in society at this point. He's being pushed out by Starfleet. He's kind of being patronized by Kira, who's trying to make him feel good by getting him a little job through the Bajoran provisional government.
Yeah.
Odo just doesn't know what to do with himself. Well, what would... Cam, let's say Odo did put in his papers, as he threatened to do, and he was no longer the chief of security on Deep Space Nine. What would he do with himself?
Fry cook?
Perhaps. Like, I don't know. Like, I honestly don't know what... Would he go hang out with Dr. Mora on Bajor, or...?
They seem to get along well.
Yeah. So to me, that's a fascinating kind of discussion that's being brought up there.
I really was almost taken aback by, I'd forgotten about really, like, angry Odo. Because you don't encounter a lot of that, you know, going revisiting season one and two.
Well, I think the Quark-Odo dynamic, when they're bunking together, and just how uncomfortable Odo was with the idea that somebody should see him in his liquid state.
Right.
He ends up finding himself on a planet where, hey, go for it, you know? Like, being in a solid state is fine, but you can be around essentially your family in your liquid state. And, you know, just seeing Odo at ease so much throughout, it's interesting to see angry Odo in part one and then Odo at ease in part two. I think that's very, very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I actually really enjoyed that scene with Quark and Odo in the quarters, and it actually reminded me a lot of... A far more comedic scene, but the scene of Picard and Data in the uncomfortable quarters in Unification.
Yes.
It's sort of that contrast between a character who just, you know, wants to essentially, you know, relax or go to sleep or whatever, you know, with Odo Picard, and then the character that's kind of badgering them.
Sure.
And I think in both cases, it draws a lot of out of the characters involved in these kind of squabbles.
You know, that's a great example of some great character moments. Mm-hmm. Other stuff, I like the discussion Jadzia and Ben were having about whether Ben would want to be an admiral. And that's something you and I discussed back in Ranking the Captains episode from a few months ago, whether Ben would have been destined for a job as an admiral. And Curzon, you know, Jadzia's recounting Curzon's memories about how Ben, it's not just enough for Ben to give the orders. He wants to be the one acting on them as well. So I think that's a very fascinating discussion. And even Ben and Jake talking about how they finally realize that Deep Space Nine is now home for them.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of good stuff. And
you really like that scene of Jake eating pudding, didn't you?
It's going to be my new wallpaper on my phone. So, and... So we've got all these character beats leading up to this Jem'Hadar ambush, and you and I, we've mocked a lot of the, some of the action sequences, in Star Trek.
Right.
You know, I actually thought this ambush was quite well done, like, aboard the ship.
I don't know.
I could be grading on a curve here with, regards to Star Trek, but among what we've seen in Star Trek, this is, a step above what we've, typically seen before. This was no, fight over a piece of pottery on the planet that Picard is playing archaeologist on in Gambit.
Getting back, I want to talk about pottery in a minute. Just remind me about that, because I want to get back to that after I respond to this. That fight, I think the key to why it works as well as it does, and I don't think it's that successful, but I think it's fine. But I think the key is that it keeps it frantic. There's a real, you know, because of the quick cuts and the kind of the shaky cam, essentially.
Well, even just like, I usually hate like the close shots.
Yeah.
But I think this works in just this claustrophobia, that's so present throughout this sequence. It works for me.
Yeah. And I think it also captures sort of the desperation of, you know, the crew in this moment. And I actually really love how that scene ends with Kira being, you know, stunned.
Yeah.
I think that was a great touch.
So, Kim, tell me, what's the deal with this? It seems as if in Star Trek, everybody has to use, like, a two-fisted blow to incapacitate their enemies.
Yeah, this is the part that doesn't work for me.
Have you ever seen somebody in a street fight do a two-fisted blow?
Well, me, just me.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's you and me fighting each other. We exchange two-fisted blows.
People are, like, waving dollar bills at us. No, it's the fact that, like, the Jem'Hadar have been introduced as so terrifying that I just always have had trouble buying it, especially in kind of scenes like this where I'm watching, like, Sisko and, you know, Kira just, like, double-fist these characters. The Jem'Hadar feel to me a little too scary to... you know, to even deal with this type of fighting. Like, I feel like a Jem'Hadar is just going to take you out like a Reaver from Serenity.
Well, the whole thing here is, it's the same move again and again. Just take away the Jem'Hadar's rifle, hit him with his rifle, and go on to the next one.
Yeah.
Why not shoot the rifle, guys?
The genius is what, you know, later down in the series when Worf takes them on. Like, you buy that more because they make Worf, you know, more vicious and violent. Like, essentially, he can beat them at their own game. I don't know that I can buy that really that Bashir's taken down a single one of them.
Well, and this is before we knew that he was genetically enhanced.
He didn't seem that genetically enhanced.
Maybe just in the mind, not the body.
I think so.
Okay.
Although, I like to think Sadig Alpha, I was like, no, the body. Definitely the body.
Yeah. What other stuff?
I want to talk about pottery.
Yes.
There's a scene you mentioned earlier where you were talking about how you really like that scene with Jake and Sisko. And how they're essentially have decided that the station is their home. And Ben is putting up this African art that he has, his pottery. And he references that it's 2,000 years old. Is this something that happens in the future? People just have, like, really ancient antiques at home? Like, are there no museums?
Maybe there's just so many of them. Maybe they've unearthed so many over the past few centuries that they're worthless, essentially.
Tyler, it belongs in a museum.
No, I'm just going to put it in a wooden crate and stuff it in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, I don't know. That scene kind of jumped out at me because it's one of those things, you know, we often have joked about Star Trek and money and everything. But in a future where essentially there is no value, do people just take ancient artifacts and, like, hang them in their house?
I think Ben walked into a museum and said, "That'll be mine. Thank you." Hey, look, if it's socialism, what's mine is yours, you know, you can just take it however he pleases.
Screw you, Smithsonian.
Yeah, so, yeah, some good pottery. I should probably make some in time for next year's convention in Las Vegas.
Good point, yeah.
Sell it in the halls.
Tell them it'll be worth something. Well, I guess not worth anything in 2,000 years, but you can hang it. It'll look really nice on a spaceship wall.
Yeah. Before we move on to part two, though, what do you think of Sisko specifically calling Odo out on the fact that he's not a team player and Starfleet likes team players? I think that's very kind of succinct way to summarize a guy who can be kind of difficult to work with at times.
I agree. But what I really liked about that scene also is the fact that, you know, Star Trek typically outside of Deep Space Nine has a really lofty worship of the Federation. And I liked that this moment with Sisko, he's saying, you know, he's supporting essentially the Federation's decision. But I like that he's also saying, it's not what I'd do.
Yeah.
Like, he does, this is like the time, you know, the really exciting time in DS9 where Ira Stephen Bear is like, you know what, maybe the Federation isn't 100% perfect.
Yeah, and we even got that in the Maquis parts 1 and 2, and Sisko said, hey, when he's talking about life on Earth, he said, it's easy to be a saint when you're living in paradise.
Yeah.
And I think it's very much an Iris Stephen Bear sort of viewpoint on the Federation, where, look, things are rosy for some people, but let's not kid ourselves. The galaxy is a big place, and it can be a dangerous place, which we've learned over the course of hundreds of Star Trek episodes.
Yeah, no, exactly. Do you think Voyager would have seemed maybe a little less stuffy if had it come out before DS9? Because I feel like when you have DS9 come out and have these grand statements about the Federation, when we then cut to Voyager further down the road and they're just like, you know, hey, Mackie, throw on a Starfleet uniform. And then, you know, they love Starfleet within 10 minutes.
Yes.
It just feels to me maybe false in a way that it wouldn't have had it come out before DS9.
So essentially, if Voyager had premiered, before Deep Space Nine,
yeah,
and they would have been kind of in a static sort of bubble on the other side of the galaxy where they could kind of live up to these ideals, or is it just because the writers only addressed some of the hypocrisies going on in the Federation further down the road in Deep Space Nine?
I think it's the writers. Just artistically, this show was driven by the idea of questioning the status quo, essentially. Voyager is not.
Yeah, it's interesting because TNG doesn't seem... look, it's certainly a stuffier show compared to Deep Space Nine.
Stuffier, we say, in a fond way.
Yeah.
But yes.
But it doesn't... I don't think people look at TNG and find it to be, a proponent of these hypocritical values. I think there's a certain reverence that people hold for TNG that even though Deep Space Nine came around and really kind of held the spotlight on some stuff that doesn't really make sense in the 24th century,
yeah,
I think TNG gets away with it in maybe a way that Voyager does not.
Yeah, and it's something that just really jumped out watching this two-parter to me is that it just feels so like edgy and smart and sophisticated in a way that just Voyager never really tried.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think about the introductions of Lieutenant Commander Eddington and one Subcommander T'Rul?
I mean, Eddington doesn't really have anything to do in Part 1.
Mm-hmm.
We get a quick intro. We see he has a brief little clash with Odo, but you don't get a lot of Eddington. I was actually surprised how little I got, essentially, because I thought, because I know Eddington so well because of the legacy of where he goes.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of took me a little bit by surprise how he's just kind of introduced and then forgotten for the rest of Part 1.
And it is interesting that when Sisko and Kira are discussing Odo's status aboard the station as Chief of Security, Sisko specifically says, well, Starfleet needed somebody they could trust.
Yeah.
A Maquis operative.
Wah, 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 wah.
Yeah.
Do you think this was planned out at that point? Like,
no.
Was there no long game for now?
No, not at all. Because I think it could have been very easy for them to get rid of Eddington, mm-hmm. but they kept him around much longer than... I think they... I'm kind of surprised that they kept him around as long as they did, because I like Kenneth Marshall. I like the character. But it's not as if this guy pops on screen and he's just brimming with personality.
Right. Maybe that's why he works so well, though.
Yeah. Okay, what about T'Rul?
T'Rul is a character who I thought was really interesting because before we watched this two-parter, I sat and did some research on Memory Alpha and read about how initially this character was played by Martha Hackett, was intended to become maybe a recurring character on the show. The second time through, I really watched her character from that point of view of thinking, like, does this character contribute a lot where I would want to see her every week, like a Garrick or something like that. A character who every time they'd pop up, I'd be like, oh, man, they're back. No.
No.
This character just really didn't pop to me.
She didn't seem to have any nuance. She didn't seem very interesting
or
layered. She just seemed angry.
And this is a Romulan character on DS9, which should be, like, really exciting.
Yeah, because we've seen other Romulan characters pop up in Deep Space Nine who were interesting.
Yeah.
She didn't even get to sit down at a console on the Defiant Bridge. She had to stand up and push this really dinky panel. And, I can understand why the writers would say, hey, this is a good opportunity to get some Romulans aboard the ship.
Yeah.
Or aboard the station.
And the idea of a recurring Romulan character on DS9 is exciting.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that, kind of like an interesting what if. Because I think it would have worked.
What stopped it from working, Cam? Was it the page or the actress? Because they obviously like the actress. They cast her as Seska in Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah.
What went wrong here?
I just feel like, when we talked about this Part 1 especially, there's a lot of exposition, there's a lot of setting up for the series that's, to come. I just don't think there was really that much time to introduce this character. And also, Eddington is introduced in a way where, yeah, he's not in the show that much, but he's introduced in a role that inspires conflict, because he's, this Federation security chief, he's going to be kind of jockeying for positions with Odo. right there, we're invested in the idea of what this character could lead to.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with Taru is that, I mean, she's in the background working on a comm or whatever, working on a panel in Defiant. There's nothing about her that really jumped out at me and said, like, what could this character do next?
And I definitely think they're setting up this season as, like, hey, look at Odo. Mm-hmm. He's a founder, essentially. He's from the same species as the founders. So we definitely, if we want to set up some conflict with Odo, we can have a character like Eddington. But then they're like, well, what do we do with, you know, this Romulan who's hanging around the space station? Like, I just wonder if they were kind of, they couldn't really think of anything to do with her at this point.
And really, her juiciest scene for me is in a dream sequence.
Yeah, no, same here. And this is when she was arguing about why the Romulans aren't being included in treaty negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets shot in the back.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that they should have maybe given that character one more chance or something? Or do you think it was kind of like, eh, you know what? Move on.
I would say, you know what? It was a jam-packed two-part premiere episode.
Yeah.
I think the writers should have just given her one more chance, just tried a little bit harder. Because honestly, it makes sense. The Romulans, we keep seeing the Defiant use this cloaking device. It makes sense for the Romulans to want to keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
So why not just, I don't know, give it a passing acknowledgement that she's still around. She got moved down to main engineering or something like that.
Right.
You know, but it never really happened. She just disappears, and the Romulans don't really seem to care about their cloaking device that much.
Let's talk about the Defiant.
Yeah.
This is the introduction to arguably the most badass ship in the, you know, in the history of Star Trek. You know, when this thing shoots down like a Jem'Hadar starship, I mean, come on. That is badass.
Yes.
I was surprised, though, how kind of unsexy its introduction was. I mean, it's fine, but, you know, you expect such a grand, like, slam-bang intro for such an awesome ship.
Yeah, the introduction of it wasn't in your face, but it did have a wonderful beauty shot when it was departing for that mission on the other side of the wormhole.
Yeah.
But I do recall, like, watching this 20 years ago, I didn't know what to expect. I wasn't reading spoilers, so all of a sudden this Federation starship decloaks, and then they explain a few moments later that it's a warship. I was like, whoa, like it just kind of blew my mind, you know. Yeah, maybe not the most glamorous looking shot, but I actually think is because they wanted to save it for that beauty shot, you know, because I think it is kind of interesting if you can build up some mystique,
right?
You know, because they I think it was purposeful on their parts that they did not want to show a long or like a wide angle shot of it until further on in the series. They wanted to give you just glimpses, and then you have to use your imagination, and then anticipation builds up. You're like, what is this thing? What does it look like? And when you finally see it as it departs for its mission, I think that's even more exciting. So I'm actually like kind of, I like the way that this was introduced.
I like that, you know, it kind of introduces it in a way where you're kind of like, well, yeah, it looks pretty cool. But they kind of downplay it. They're like, well, you know, it has a lot of problems, a lot of flaws.
Yeah.
But then when you see it take down a Jem'Hadar fighter, it's like, oh my god. Like, the firepower on this thing is just so insane. Now, you compare it to, like, a modern-day sci-fi action sequence, it's nothing. It's pretty much standard. You know, like, J.J. Abrams' Enterprise shoots about the same way. But compared to the ships of this time, where starship combat was, like, one beam slowly happening at a time, this must have felt revolutionary when it came out.
Oh, I can tell you, Cam, it was. So, maybe moving on to part two specifically.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Changeling planet.
Yeah. Okay. You made a remark about it, but tell listeners what you think of this planet.
I mean, this planet, I really like this planet. I like that they really tried with what resources they had to make it look otherworldly and weird.
I think one of the issues I have with Star Trek is they keep saying we're exploring strange new worlds.
Yeah.
And they all look like really boring, bland places. They all look like the same kind of desert or else like the same cheap soundstage.
Yeah.
I like the fact that they're doing something different here. With the entire, you know, planet, it's a rogue planet, there's no sun. So it's all, you know, there's no actual daylight or anything like that. So it kept it dark, which I think made it look not quite as cheap as it may have otherwise looked, you know?
Doesn't hold up great in standard definition.
Sure, sure. Yeah, but no, you know, I like that they're actually trying to do something different and actually make it look like a strange new world, which is not something we get enough.
And as someone who, of course, has a unabashed love for the original series, where they do so much with so little on that series, you know, where every set is just like rocks with like a different colored sky, and yet they all feel different for some reason. I really enjoyed what they did with so little. And yes, I joked that it looked like an enchanted golf course, a miniature golf course, and I stand by that. There's that, you know, that area where, what is it, like the garden or something?
Arboretum.
Arboretum, yeah, where Odo is looking at rocks longingly. you know, it looks, yeah, like a really fun miniature golf course, but it's weird enough and inventive enough that I really appreciate the art direction that went into it, because... I mean, how many times in TNG or in Voyager do the places they land just look like either just like a cheap kind of cave set or like California, you know, landscape?
Okay, I was watching Silicon Avatar from season 5
of
Next Generation very recently, and it just struck me, like, how many caves are, like, Earth must, you know, not have nearly as many caves as other planets, because I don't spend half my life in caves here on planet
Tyler,
Earth.
Yeah. How many caves have you been in?
I think I've been in 2.
Yeah, I think I'm about the same.
So there you go. But based on what I see in Star Trek, aliens spend about half their lives in caves.
Yeah.
What's the deal with that? Even this episode featured a cave. That's where they're holding everybody in those stasis chambers with the consciousness, collective consciousness going on.
Right, yeah. I don't know what that is. I guess because caves are cheap sets to have.
Okay.
Relatively.
I just wish that they go for something a little bit more innovative than caves and rocks in Star Trek Discovery.
Prediction. I'm curious from you. When we get to Star Trek Discovery, are we going to the caves?
Well, I have actually been thinking about this, because they're going to be...
You've been thinking about this a lot, the caves?
Well, they're filming Star Trek Discovery in January in Toronto, which is a very cold place.
Yep.
So I anticipate some ice planets, but beyond that, everything's going to have to be on sets.
Yeah.
So I really hope they're thinking of doing something... innovative there, you know, I'm gonna like just, I don't know, groan so loudly if we just see those same stupid rock sets again and again and again.
I can even get it behind it if they do the caves like they do the original series, where they're really colorful and vibrant. There's something about TNG onwards when they do caves, it's just boring. Like, it just looks like a boring set.
I know that they're under the gun. CBS wants Star Trek Discovery on air as quickly as possible. I just wish they pushed filming to spring, because you could at least get, like, different sorts of looks for planets.
Right.
If you're going to get a very monolithic looking, you know, cityscape, it just covered in snow all the time.
Right. So.
Oh, well. What about the whole kind of debate about Odo's sense of justice versus this authoritarianism that is so present throughout the Dominion? I find it very interesting, and I think it's even more topical nowadays when you look at what's happening in politics, much of the developed world, where there's these populist movements. And people are looking at, you know, the election of one Donald Trump, and they're trying to figure out, you know, who's voting for them. And they find that... those kind of values align not with, say, socioeconomic things. It's actually, when they tested people, it's actually more than anything else, their affinity for authoritarianism.
Right.
So it's interesting that we can have that kind of topic coming up 20 years in the past on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I find it fascinating. Like, Odo, where did you get this sense of justice? Because it's even genetically programmed into him to eventually search out this Omarian nebula that he eventually finds the homeworld on. Is that sense of justice something he learned from his time around the solids? Is it something programmed into him? It doesn't seem to be from, say, the Founders.
What I find fascinating about Odo is that while he's not necessarily as iconic as like a Spock or a Data, he plays the same role in the series. He's an outsider who is influenced by his encounters with humans and various different types of aliens. And essentially, his evolution through the series is the same as, you know, those other characters. You know, it's how he is changed because of them. and discovers who he is through that process. And that's one thing I think is really fascinating, is to see how Odo stands opposed to what his own people, you know, believe. But essentially, they're isolated. They've been living in complete isolation for fear of their own safety. Mm-hmm. Whereas Odo is someone who's become like a man, even though he's not really, but a man of the world. He's seen things. He's gone through, obviously, the Cardassian rule of Bajor, the Federation, you know, occupation of DS9. And he's someone who's kind of come to his own value system. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I like the idea that he arrived at his own value system independently. And it could have just been derived from witnessing what was going on during that Cardassian occupation. Mm-hmm. And saying, well, this is not just. But Odo was known among both the Bajorans and the Cardassians as being somebody who would look at all situations fairly. And that's why he eventually assumed his role.
Odo's not a character you would really refer to as like a cerebral character. Right. But he's someone who we see in this episode making an educated decision, which is something the Founders aren't really.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. What do you think about Borath, the Vorta here? He's no Jeffrey Combs as Weyoun, but I'm...
Or Iggy Pop.
I'm kind of surprised that they did not bring him back. There's only a few Vorta that they brought back. I know Leland Crook played, was it Kevon or is that Iggy Pop's? I think Kevon appeared twice.
Okay.
And... yeah, I think it's just Kevon and Weyoun were the only Vorta to make multiple appearances.
I think the key to being good at playing a Vorta is that you have to be smarmy.
Yeah.
And you've got to sell it. Like, you've got to come across as so just like, you just don't want to trust these people.
Well, I think it's interesting that you think of Jeffrey Combs as the typical Vorta.
Yeah.
You know, but it's interesting to think that Borath... He sounds very much like Borat from...
He does.
Anyway, but that Borath...
I would like to see that spinoff.
That'd be amazing. But Borath has that smarminess right out of the gate as well. Kevon has it as well. Mm-hmm. Iggy Pop, whatever that guy's name was, they all kind of have it. It's not necessarily only because Jeffrey Combs played that role. Because I think To the Death, I forget if that's a season 3 or a season 4 episode, but I think it takes a little while longer for Weyoun to show up in the series.
Right. I think it's season 4, isn't it?
It might be.
Yeah. What I really like about the Vorta is that they feel so perfected right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something we've seen in other Star Trek series where it takes a while to figure out an alien species. Ferengi, Klingons. But I love that DS9 had such a firm grasp on a lot of the aliens it chose to introduce. And I mean, the Vorta, even though they aren't necessarily the big sexy, you know, alien characters of DS9, like, I don't know if people really look back and go, boy, I love those Vorta on DS9.
Sure.
They are so perfect right out of the gate, and they feel consistent right through. Like, you could transport these aliens right into another series. You know, they don't feel like they need to be changed in any way.
Yeah, I agree.
And they were perfect here. You know, the actor, who's the actor who played him?
It was Dennis Christopher.
Okay, yeah, like Dennis Christopher, yeah, he may not have reoccurred, but perfect Vorta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about one of the stalwarts for Star Trek character actors, John Fleck? He was playing in part one that Tulaberry wine buyer. But he, of course, probably best known as playing the main Suliban in Enterprise. I'm blanking on his name right now.
Oh, yes, yes.
So, some performance. He was a very distinct alien featured in this particular episode.
Yeah, that's true. And he was, again, a lot of fun. What is it about DS9 that, you know, how many times did they introduce just sort of a, you know, one-shot alien character? And they just feels like they have such a life outside of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, how many did we see pop up on TNG, Voyager, Enterprise, etc., where they just don't feel like they have that same inner life they have on DS9?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, and I appreciate Deep Space Nine for being able to do that.
It's that certain, you know, je ne sais quoi. I can't say that Iris Stephen Bear was sitting there being like, how do I make this alien really feel rich and developed? It just, there's something about this show that just maybe creates an atmosphere where the aliens just are allowed to breathe a little more.
Yeah, before the Founders come and suffocate them.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah,
Cam, any final thoughts on the search parts 1 and 2?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about a scene, actually, that Armin Shimerman really did not like.
Mm.
And that is a scene in part 1, which is where Quark is kind of given his orders by Sisko. to kind of go as a ambassador for Ferenginar, and Sisko makes him kiss the Negus's staff.
Yeah, it was quite suggestive in a way.
Armin Shimmerman felt he really disagreed with the scene. He felt it was essentially a scene to humiliate the Ferengi.
Yeah.
In a way that, and he's talked at cons, you know, going forward, that he often felt the Ferengi were kind of treated a little bit unfairly by the franchise. And this did feel like a very strange moment in a two-parter. It doesn't really feel rife with this sort of, I guess, attempts at comedy.
I guess it was an attempt. It's just very bizarre. Did you feel like laughing that much?
No, it was creepy.
Yeah.
Like, Sisko, you know, Avery Brooks had a very strange look on his face.
I think you and I may have chuckled, not because we found it funny, but because we were both thinking, like, what the hell is that? Like, what did we just watch?
Like, yeah, it's a real, like, misstep in an otherwise, you know, really solid two-parter. Like, you know, we can argue back and forth about whether, you know, the cheat in the second half with the dream sequence or exposition in the first half, but it feels consistent and part of a whole, whereas this scene is jarring.
Yeah.
It feels like it's taken from, like, another episode or something.
And I do want to say, even though I complained about that kind of dream sequence, I thought The Search, parts 1 and 2, was a very strong two-parter, a great way to really kick off season 3 of Deep Space Nine. And I do recall as a kid, like, I kept tuning in week to week until Voyager premiered. And then I kind of trailed off Deep Space Nine a little bit. But I think I do recall that The Search parts 1 and 2 was the first time I really got into Deep Space Nine back in those mid-90s years.
Yeah. There was one scene I want to talk about, actually, which is with the Changeling founder, who talks about the name Changeling and how this was a term come up with the Solids to insult them, and they've now taken it and now refer to themselves as this. I thought this was kind of a strange scene. In a sense, like, I was surprised that they wouldn't just have their own term for themselves.
Sure. Well, the founders.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, Star Trek often has, like, puts a lot of attention into detail in terms of giving these alien cultures kind of their own language or their own terms for themselves, which aren't human. Whereas founders, changelings, that's very human-based.
Oh, but you know what? They're not Solids.
Well,
so they're taking names from the Solids, and that's how they're explaining it to other Solids.
Sure.
So it actually makes sense to me.
I want their unpronounceable psychic name for themselves, just like fair channeled enough right into my brain.
Nice.
But no, I agree with you. Like, I think The Search part 1 and 2, when I watched this, like, my memories of it were, like, when I watched this two-parter, it felt different, and it felt like this was not what I had experienced before on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And when I look back at the whole of the series, it's often tough for me to break down, you know, because DS9 is such an arc, it's often tough to break down sort of the parts of the overall arc. But The Search part 1 and 2 has always popped out to me as crucial, you know, a crucial story within that tale.
And this is why I'll often recommend people start Deep Space Nine watching with the Jem'Hadar or else The Search parts 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a good three consecutive episodes really that really establish where Deep Space Nine is going to go from here on out.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, Tyler, we always say, I think it's fairly obvious, does it justify itself as a two-parter?
In this case, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree, 100%.
Excellent.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of The Search. Are you a big fan? Do you think it's as good as we think it is? Do you agree with Empire Magazine that it's the greatest Deep Space Nine episode of all time?
Yeah, obviously, Empire.
So, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
I'm sad to say, Cam, but the year's coming to a close.
What?
Yeah, so we are going to be sharing with you our best moments throughout all of 2016.
It's going to be a very short episode.
For those who may have missed some episodes here or there, I think it's a good way to kind of catch up on some things. You and I will also be discussing some new things as well, so tune in, even if you've listened to every single episode this year. It'll be great, and we'll probably be setting up some expectations for 2017 as well. I think 2017 is going to be the most exciting year in Star Trek for quite some time.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vorta, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nicheev, only in my dreams.
So until next time, the arena is closed.
Complete.